Hello everyone. We are going to present our talk in the style of a radio documentary, so please save any questions until the end. It's based on an idea by Michael Bartlett. Until the 1950s, announcers and presenters were required to wear dinner jackets after 8 o'clock. Indeed, A.J. Allen went one stage further when broadcasting his short stories, always wearing a DJ. He pasted his script onto sheets of cardboard so that it made no noise, and lit a candle in case the electricity failed. The show would go on, and the listener would be none the wiser. The quality of sound is vital to the medium of radio, and the SM has an important role to play here. For our purposes, I am the SM, the studio manager. The extracts you will hear are from our drama collection, either recorded off-air by us or donated to us. As we need to test the speaker level so that you can hear the recordings, I am going to use the beginning of a story written and read by A.J. Allen.
One day this summer, while we were down in Devonshire for our holidays, we went out prawning. And as the weather was hot and I suppose the prawns were feeling too idle to get out of the way, we caught quite a good number, and that was that. On our way home along the beach, we kept on coming across patches of that pink, feathery sort of seaweed you often see, and my wife thought some of it looked rather nice floating in a large glass bowl we'd got. So we picked up a certain amount of this stuff, this seaweed, and in order to keep it fresh, we just dropped it into the tin of salt water we were carrying the prawns in. We didn't think they'd mind. As it turned out, it wasn't at all a clever idea, because when we got back, we found that the prawns had thoroughly tangled themselves up in this seaweed. I mean, you know what an awful lot of arms and legs and whiskers and things prawns have, which catch on everything, and it was quite a business to undo them. However, we did at last manage to sort them out, and the prawns went into a saucepan of boiling water, and the seaweed was put into its glass bowl. Very well. About an hour later, someone happened to look in the glass bowl, and they noticed that there was one odd prawn swimming about all by itself, like a goldfish. Must have been overlooked somehow. And we all started arguing about what we ought to do with it.
Good. Now, could we all hear? If you want to find out what happened to Percy the Prawn, you can find the recording, because it's been released on the internet. So now, over to Nigel, who is presenting The Art and Craft of Radio Drama.
I wonder how many of you recognise this.
Dan Archer has bought Jack's small holding in Ambridge. Yesterday, Peggy and the children packed up the house and went to make a new home with Jack on their Cornish farm. Mrs. Perkins, who went with them to help get the house straight, left her cat, Whiskey, with Walter Gabriel for safekeeping. Jane Maxwell, who left Fairbrothers on Friday, is also due to leave Ambridge today. It's been arranged that after she's collected her baggage from Mrs. Perkins' house, she'll give the key to Phil. Phil is examining Fairbrothers' poultry this morning when Grace approaches him and reminds him of her earlier statement that she wanted to do some work.
Phil?
Yeah?
You remember what I said when you first brought me home in the car from London?
What, about taking over Jane's job, you mean?
Yes. Couldn't I?
Probably be quite a big help if you really want to do the job.
I do, Phil, honestly.
Well, have you told your father? What does he say about it?
He didn't seem particularly worried. He was rather preoccupied with another matter, I believe, on Mrs. Carey's behalf.
Oh.
So here I am, reporting for duty.
What, dressed like that?
What's wrong?
Nothing. You look marvellous. The slacks are smashing and the sweater's just the job, but they're far too good for working clothes.
Oh, I thought they looked rather nice.
Oh, they do. I'd like to have you about the place permanently like that, but if you're going to work, well, you'd need a new outfit every week.
Well, I wasn't proposing to start this morning.
Oh.
I merely wanted to be formally introduced to the poultry.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can have me in dungarees and leather jerkin if you like.
Fair enough. Well, look, I've just been forking over this litter here. I'll explain all about it in due course. But the chief thing is that it means less work in cleaning, watering and feeding.
That was the familiar sound of The Archers. You might not recognise the actors. It's 72 years since that episode was broadcast. The man was Norman Painting, who played Phil Archer until his death in 2009. The woman was Yzanne Churchman, playing Grace Archer. The amount of drama on Radio 4 has been cut recently, as you'll be aware, and there won't be any more drama on Radio 3. But there's still a lot of new plays going out. As well as The Archers, the BBC commissions about 150 new plays each year. Most of them are broadcast in the afternoon. The audience for afternoon plays each week is huge, about 4 million. That's as many as go to see a play at the theatre in a year. On the radio, we get all kinds of plays. Not everything is a masterpiece, but we get thrillers, domestic drama, political plays, biography, adaptations, drama documentaries, escapism, and comedy. Here's part of a famous comedy by Giles Cooper from 1955. The title, Under the Loofah Tree. It's about a man in his bath.
So far. Warm, but not agony. Bend the knees. Oh! No, no, I can stand it. Sit. Lie.
Ted, don't take all the hot.
What?
All the hot. Don't take it.
Why?
When it's washing up, you'll never think.
Never think? Never do anything else but think. All the time thinking. What do women do in their heads that they can talk like that? I will have a little more hot, I think. Being boiled alive in a pot for cannibals in a humorous joke.
For Mr. Edward Thwaite is in the most extraordinary state. His toes are boiled to tenderness, but his head containing all his cleverness is cool as any refrigerator.
You'll be okay, sooner or later.
You can see the potential here for entertaining dialogue. We have a man in the bath, the door is locked, various people want his attention, and he doesn't like it. That's the plot. The BBC has kept recordings of some of its plays, but up to the year 2000, most programmes were not kept. In fact, 97% of plays up to the millennium were discarded. There were good reasons for this. The first was expense. Early on, the only way to record a play was to make a gramophone record. But this cost a great deal of money. Here's the start of a play from 1939. You can hear the crackle of the disc.
This is the BBC Home Service. We present Aaron's Field, a morality play for the eve of war by D.G. Brightson. The action takes place on September the 1st, 1939. Aaron's Field.
Under the shoulder of the fells that pile away to the blue north, where grass is golden and the bracken stains of rust as the ling puts forth. There where the trees are dark patches and fir woods flame with autumn birches. There where the river guides the dale and hawthorn shelters the grey stone walls. Where grass is benty with nettle and thistle and lapwings wail and the curlews whistle. There in the valley of late life lies a field. Not very many acres are to it, and small profit comes from its run of grass and clover. But there where it rides the fell, perched on its edge and looking over the sweep of the river that hems the bottom, stands a cottage. Four small windows dot the white of its wall before, and a narrow strip of garden lies behind the gate which guards the door. Each is a plea for standing still and thinking of work when the work ceases, and feeling the twilight gently fill the mellow hollows and empty places that come when life is nearly over. And there lives one whose work is over, a friendly man who looks for quiet, who smokes his pipe and loves his field and never thinks what acres yield. His nature and his lot the same, a man of peace, and Aaron is his name.
That play is about a man finishing work after 40 years and buying a field. Various people try to take it off him. It was very popular and received about 6 repeats. When tape recorders came along, the BBC started to keep more programmes. Here's a typical BBC tape, and you can see it's quite big. This contains a 60-minute recording recorded at 14 inches per second. The BBC stored most of its recordings on tape like this until the mid-1990s. They are expensive to store, just look at the size. The second reason that the BBC didn't keep many of its plays, though, is performing rights. After 2 repeats, a programme couldn't be used again unless the BBC paid more royalties to the writer and to the actors. The recordings you'll hear in this programme are from our own drama collection. We have thousands of plays which the BBC was unable to keep. Radio plays are special. They're different from plays on television or film or stage. You can't see what's going on, and this means the listener has to supply the pictures. The writer helps you do this, and he gives you clues about the bits you can't see. Let's go back to Edward in his bath.
I belong to Glasgow, dear old Glasgow town. And what's the matter with Glasgow for it's going round and round? I'm only a common old working man, as anyone here can see. But when I get a drink on a Saturday night... What?
It's man.
Glasgow belongs to me.
There's a man at
that door. What's he want?
Wants you.
I'm having a bath.
Says he must see you.
Keep him talking.
I can't. I've got a fish pie on.
Well...
I've got nothing on. I've got a fish pie on. This season's model has worn by.
Sam?
Who are you?
A traveller, sir. Your good lady let me in.
But why have you travelled here?
You sent for me, sir.
Never.
Oh, yes, sir. I have your form of application.
For a chap to come and talk to me while I have my bath?
For further information about Shumbles.
Shumbles?
The encyclopedia, sir. Shumbles Encyclopedia, 24 volumes, including the index and gazetteer.
Oh, I thought you were going to be an illustrated brochure.
No, sir, I'm a personal representative. May I inquire whether you'll be long at your ablutions?
Yes, I'm dirty.
Because I have here some specimen pages, including 2 of the 400 colour plates, which I would like you to look at. So, this is really your last chance, in a manner of speaking.
My last chance of what?
Of obtaining the position, the money, the power to which knowledge is the key. Shumble, sir, will open doors to you.
He can't open my bathroom door.
You can see that radio drama paints pictures in the mind. The play continues with a series of people arriving, but he won't open the door. Here are some clues about what works on radio and what doesn't. This is Don Howarth speaking on Radio New Zealand in 1985.
As his accent indicates, Don Howarth comes from Lancashire, born in Bacup, 1924. And today, you meet a small, quiet, modest man, but one with a shrewd eye and a vivid turn of phrase. After his service in the Royal Air Force during the Second World War, he set about becoming a writer, and Don has ranged successfully from journalism to award-winning TV documentary, and from Hollywood to the London stage. But it's the radio play, which he took up so accidentally, that has become the core of Don Howarth's work. I wanted to know first about his view of the special difficulties the radio writer has to cope with.
The main constraint is that it is really impossible to suggest physical action in radio, people running up and down steps and banging doors and jumping into cars. No sense really can be made of that in radio. But it has this great virtue, as the boy said when he was asked, that he preferred radio to television because the backgrounds were better. And it is possible to do things on many, many different sets. Things constantly in motion from location to location. Not people moving physically, there is a problem with that. But simply changing the location and doing this with words. And people then see the location from their own imagination, which is far more satisfactory. And the listener really does half the work. It is a cooperative act of the writer, of the producer, and of the actors, and then of the listener, and each listener makes the play again in his own image.
So, on radio, you can't suggest physical action, but you can move rapidly from one location to another. This is not possible in any other medium. The four tools of the radio writer are dialogue, music, sound effects, and silence. Certain things work better on radio than television or stage. Here's an example, a play set in a garden. The characters are slightly unusual.
On a Day in Summer in a Garden by Don Howarth. With Colin Blakely as Dick Dock, Jeffrey Banks as Jim Dock, and Julie Hallam as Jack Dock.
Nice morning.
Aye, grand. Nippy, though.
Morning mist and morning dew. Going to be hot today, young Jack?
Is it, Grandad?
Oh, when the sun strikes through on a hot day, early summer, there's no better thing in creation than to be a dock plant in this garden.
Because we fear nothing.
Correct.
What is there to fear, Uncle Jim?
Nothing.
Encroachment.
What's encroachment, Uncle Jim?
The other plants encroaching.
But we don't fear it.
Tempting to choke us.
Because we're more than equal.
Sometimes.
Always, Jim?
Not always, Dick. A large number of dock plants have been lost through the years.
You're here, I'm here, young Jack's here. This is our patch of the garden.
We've tried to teach them that.
Well, then, it's finally sunk in.
I don't think those daisies will come again.
What's daisies?
Surface leaf, white flower, close up at night. We throttled them.
Choked the life out.
And before that, the charlock.
And before that, the cornflower.
And before that, the hoary pepperwort.
Forget-me-not.
Nettle annual.
Bramble.
Wild turnip and shepherd's needle.
Pennycress and sow thistle.
The creeping buttercup.
Deadly nightshade.
And was the poppy before that?
And when was the groundsel?
And the tares. And the dandelions.
And the thistles and treacle mustard.
It's hard to remember which came in what year. We've choked them all in our time.
So we can see here, on radio, the characters don't have to be human. It doesn't matter what they are. In one play by Neil Brand, the central character is an old piano. In another by Simon Brett, the main character is a sofa. You may have noticed something odd about the actor playing the young male dock plant. it was actually voiced by a woman. And up to 1975, it was normal for boys' parts to be taken by women. Actors sometimes say never work with children or animals. Okay, let's move back to our female boy in the garden.
Grandad?
Son.
Grandad, the persons move and the buttercups creep and we're rooted, aren't we?
We are indeed. Steadfast.
Why do the persons move?
It's to get out of the way of the bullocks.
I've never heard that, Jim.
Yes. The docks in the field, the bullocks bogged on them.
They did last summer.
Flatten them under a right sloppy load.
Is that more dangerous than the creeping buttercup, Uncle Jim?
Not really. Merely unpleasant. Cake with dung and dust accumulating and flies buzzing around.
Distasteful more than anything.
Yeah, distasteful.
I was asking about the persons moving.
Well, that's the explanation. They move so they don't get bogged on by the bullocks.
But the bullocks can move too, Uncle Jim.
Yes.
So that if the persons move, the bullocks can also move and bog on them where they've moved to.
That's right, Jim.
Perhaps. It doesn't seem to work out like that in practice.
Perhaps that's why he closes the gate.
How?
So the bullocks can't follow into the house and bog on in there.
Now, that was the tank. That was his tank. Listen.
He can't spray today, not with this breeze blowing.
Is it blowing? It's dropped.
Of course it's blowing. It blew the caterpillar. You'd miss half the happenings of life under the shelter of that wall.
Why can't he spray if it's blowing?
It'd blow the spray over him. He'd go orange and purple and mottled. He'd crack like a rotten stick.
Is that what happens when you're sprayed, Grandad?
Yes, it is.
Quite apart from the breeze, it's clouded over. It's going to rain. He can't spray today.
He doesn't seem to have your grasp of the subject, Dick. He's about to commence.
You can see vivid description is essential here. It keeps us with the action. The docks will crack like a rotten stick if they're sprayed. The challenge for the writer is to convey all of the information through sound alone. Here's an example of how not to do it, and this was written by actor Timothy West as a joke. The characters tell each other lots of things just for the sake of the listener. It's even been used to help writers design decent scripts. This play is called This Gun in My Right Hand is Loaded.
Who's that?
Who do you think, Laura, my dear? Your husband.
Why, Clive. Hello, Daddy.
Hello, Richard. My, what a big boy you're getting. Let's see, how old are you now?
I'm 6, Daddy.
Now, Daddy's tired, Richard. Run along upstairs and I'll call you when it's supper time.
All right, Mummy.
What's that you've got under your arm, Clive?
It's an evening paper, Laura. I've just been reading about the Oppenheimer smuggling case. Good gracious, it's nice to sit down after that long train journey from the insurance office in the city.
Let me get you a drink, Clive, darling.
Thank you, Laura, my dear. Amontillado, eh? Good stuff. What are you having?
I think I'll have a whiskey, if it's all the same to you.
Whiskey, eh? That's a strange drink for an attractive, auburn-haired girl of 29. Is there anything wrong?
No, it's nothing, Clive.
Yes?
No, really,
You're my wife, Laura. Whatever it is, you can tell me. I'm your husband. Why, we've been married, let me see, 8 years, isn't it?
Yes, I'm sorry, Clive. I'm being stupid. It's just this.
This? Why, what is it, Laura?
It's a letter. I found it this morning in the letterbox. The Amsterdam postmark and the strange crest on the back. It frightened me. It's addressed to you. Perhaps you'd better open it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, dash it. I've left my reading glasses at the office. Oh. Read it to me, will you, my dear?
Very well. Let's see. Dear Mr. Barrington, If you would care to meet me in the lounge bar of Berridge's Hotel at 7:30
on Tuesday evening, the 21st of May.
The play is so bad it's quite funny. Let's hear part of the next scene in the lounge bar.
Evening, George. What are you having?
No. Let me.
Now, come on.
Well, then, pint of the usual.
Two pints of the usual, please, Mabel.
Coming out, Mr. Farrell.
Evening, Norman.
Hello there, George. What are you having, Bert?
Oh, I'm just getting them, Norman.
Well, leave me out, then. I'm getting one for Charlie Illingworth. 2 hours of the usual, Mabel.
Evening, all.
Hello, Arnold. Haven't seen you in ages.
A change, Mr. Farrell.
Thanks, Mabel. Where's Charlie got to? Ah, there you are, Charlie. You know Arnold Baines, don't you?
Known the old so-and-so for ages. What do you have?
No, I'm getting them. What is it?
Oh, I'll just have my usual, thanks.
Who's looking after you then, George, old man?
There's yours, Mr. Hawkins.
Bung ho.
Cheers, George.
Cheers, Norman.
Cheers, Bert.
Cheers, Arnold. Well, look who's coming over. Isn't that young Clive Barrington from the Providential Insurance?
As happily married a man as ever I saw.
Evening, Arnold. Evening, Bert. Charlie. George. Evening, Norman.
No. How goes it? What ho then, mate? What are you having?
A whiskey, please.
Any particular brand?
I'll have the one nearest the clock.
Half a minute. There's a bloke over there can't take his eyes off you, Clive. Over in the corner, see him? Wearing a dark blue single-breasted dinner jacket and tinted spectacles. A foreigner, or my name's not George Hawkins.
You can see we have overdone sound effects, overdone descriptions, characters addressed by name every time they speak. Now listen to the opening scene of this horror story. It's by Jill Higham, and it's called Remember Me. Less is said, but to much greater effect.
Mrs. Weeder? Yes? What is it, Nancy?
There's someone on the phone, long distance. Wants to know if we've got a double room for the coming week.
Well, you know we haven't. We're booked solid over the Easter holidays.
Thought I'd better check. Only said they were acquainted with you.
Oh? What was the name?
I think he said Sutton. Would that be right?
Yes, Nancy, yes, that's right. Good girl. Leave it to me. I'll deal with it.
Hello?
Good afternoon. Thelma Whedon speaking.
Oh, hello, Mrs. Whedon. This is Paul Sutton. I don't know if you remember me. We met on several occasions when you were staying with Barbara and Alec Trent.
Oh, yes, Mr. Sutton, I remember you well. Good. And your charming wife. How is she?
Not been too good, as a matter of fact. About a flu that seems to have hung on. That's really why I'm ringing. The boys are spending the holidays with their maternal grandparents in France, and Margot and I thought we'd like a sort of recuperative break somewhere remote, away from all the pressures.
And you thought of me?
You made it all sound so idyllic. And we've never been to the Peak District. But it's only a long shot. You're probably booked up at this time of year.
When was it you wanted to come?
Saturday. For a week.
You're in luck. We've just had a cancellation.
That's marvellous. Must be fate.
Yes, indeed.
Will you need a letter of confirmation?
Oh, no, nothing like that. You'll be driving up, I take it?
Yes.
Then I'll put a direction sheet in the post. I've got your address.
Oh, please don't trouble.
Oh, it's no trouble. Larkmoor's a bit off the beaten track. I'll look forward to seeing you on Saturday, then.
We'll look forward to seeing you, too. Goodbye for now.
Goodbye. Nancy?
Yes, Mrs. Whedon?
Oh, fetch me the diary, would you? I shall have to put off one of the other couples.
What a shame.
Well, I'm afraid it can't be helped. The Suttons are rather special.
I wonder how long she's been waiting for that telephone call. The man and his wife arrive, and if we fast forward, we'll find the wife on the lawn. It's not long before we get a hint of what's going to happen to her.
Ready for a cup of tea?
Oh, Thelma, I didn't see you.
I'll put the tray down there.
Thank you. What a lovely, lazy afternoon I am having.
Why not? You're on holiday.
I do love your garden.
I'm afraid I've let it run wild. Put all my energy into the house so far.
I expect it needed a lot of work on it.
You should have seen it 18 months ago when I first came up here. The old lady hadn't done a thing to it for years. Everything riddled with damp and woodworm. A lot of the original parts blocked up. I'll show you round later if you're interested.
That would be nice.
Then come and find me when you finish your tea. I'll be in my sitting room.
Thelma! Thelma, I'm right... Thelma? Thelma?
Ah, good, you're ready.
That was the sound I heard this morning when I asked you about the radio.
Oh, my musical box. You like the tune?
Like is not the word exactly.
It's a haunting little melody, isn't it? Well, now, where shall we start? Upstairs or down? Down, I think. There's one thing I especially want you to see. Careful down the steps now.
You have no electricity down here?
No, I make do with the old oil lamps. Your eyes will soon get used to it.
Yes, it's coming in out of the sun.
Here we are then. The cellars.
They are big, aren't they?
Yes, they run the whole length of the house. When I stayed at Larkmoor as a child, I spent my whole time playing down here.
Not my idea of fun.
That's what my mother used to say. But then she didn't know what I discovered.
What was that?
I'll show you. You see round the corner here? In that wall? Look.
A door?
Yes. It was hidden behind a lot of old boxes and so forth and boarded over. That's why Cousin Emily never knew about it. Or anyone else.
Where does it lead to?
Ah, that's my surprise. Come and I'll show you. It's all right. There are lamps down here, too.
You keep them lit all the time?
No, I lit them just now for you.
Water?
Yes.
A tunnel?
That's right.
What is it?
It's an old channel way carved out by miners over 200 years ago. It's similar to the one in Speedwell Cabin, though this isn't open to tourists. Except specially chosen ones.
Apart from the story, you can hear the different locations. We had outside in the garden, inside the hotel, the cellar, where there was a slight echo, the tunnel, where we had an echo and the sound of running water. Listen to the four locations again in this shortened extract.
Ready for a cup of tea?
Oh, Thelma, I didn't see you.
I'll put the tray down there.
Thank you. What a lovely, lazy afternoon I am having.
Why not? You're on holiday.
Thelma! Thelma, I'm right... Thelma? Thelma?
Ah, good, you're ready.
You have no electricity down here?
No, I make do with the old oil lamps. Your eyes will soon get used to it.
Yes, it's coming in out of the sun.
Here we are, then. The cellars. It's all right. There are lamps down here, too.
You keep them lit all the time?
No, I lit them just now for you.
Multiple scene changes like this are more effective on radio than in any other medium. Now, what do we need for a radio play? We need three things. We need a story involving some form of conflict. We need characters. It's through them that the story will emerge. And we need dialogue to carry the story forward. Characters are important. The voice of each one must be instantly recognisable. It can get confusing if more than three people are in a scene. And also, people are complex. They're not always predictable. Here are the two main characters in a play from 1970 by Don Howarth.
Now it's all over, it's hard to remember how utterly terrified I used to be of Sergeant Percival.
Right, look to your front, lads. Shoulders back, chins in, thumbs along the seam of the trousers.
Sergeant Percival was the town hall commissionaire. He was so big and so smart. He had a red face and a moustache and rows of medal ribbons he won in dangerous battles up and down the world. I'd thought the job of a town hall messenger boy was, as the name implies, taking messages round the town hall. I'd no idea that I'd let myself in for a military career.
What is this here building in which we are now on parade?
This here building is the town hall, sir.
And to what body of young men do you have the pride and pleasure to belong?
The town hall messenger corps, sir.
You, Chincha. What is the Town Hall Messenger Corps not?
The Town Hall Messenger Corps is not a refuge for pimps and poncers, escaped Quakers and youthful drug addicts taking shelter from the rain between fixes.
Right then, look after your uniforms, get to work on your boots. Make them shine, not glimmer, shine!
Whenever these two people appear later in the play, they can be recognised straight away. Their voices are very distinctive and individual. Then we come onto dialogue, the way people talk. They don't talk grammatically. Different people say the same thing in different ways. If they come out of character, there must be a reason for it. Here's the opening of a play about army wives called Excess Baggage. Listen for the scene changes. See if you can count them. They're done skillfully. We know exactly where we are. And listen to the way the characters speak in the different locations.
God will fix bayonets! Fix bayonets! Squad! Squad! Chant!
We present Excess Baggage by Ken Blakeson.
Private Dennison?
Yes, Sarge.
Right. This form is the Merry Quarters Occupants Inventory of Accommodation Stores. For your convenience, the accommodation stores are listed in rooms of commodity groups together with details of entitlement. This facilitates your checking of the inventory, and it would be appreciated if you will lay your quarter out in a similar manner when you hand over. On handover, the accommodation stores will be checked against the inventory. This copy must not be altered and is to be produced at the handover. Got it?
Yes, Sarge.
The face! The face is all important! Fix the face so, and scream! Ah! You will now fix your faces so! Watson, you look like a tart! Contortion! Contortion! And scream! Ah! Scream! Ah! Kill! 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 Kill!
3 bedrooms, Sarge?
Yes, 3 bedrooms.
But I put in for 2.
Well, you got 3, didn't you? 3 bed, 1 bath, 1 reception, 1 dining, 1 hall and 1 shithouse. You.
A load of bloody tats! It's not some oil you're poking, it's the bloody enemy! You've got to mean it! You've got to eat! Eat! He's coming to rape your wife and kill your kids!
Crystal, shh, love, don't cry. Daddy won't be long.
You don't have to stand out there, you know, love.
What?
I'm waiting here if you like.
You what?
I've got the kettle on.
I don't know. He said to stay here.
It'll be a good half hour yet.
I'd better wait. Thanks anyway.
Suit yourself. It's warmer in there, though.
And if we're going to be neighbours, we might as well get to know each other.
Yeah. Well, just for a few minutes then. Ta.
I think there were 6 scenes in that extract. And notice how easily the action flowed from one scene to the next. Now, we get to plots. The plot of a radio play is important, and radio producer Gordon House says this: don't make the story too complicated. Don't use too many characters. Keep it simple. Here's Don Howarth talking about plots.
It seems to me that You can't stray too far in film or stage from the world of reality, if you like, whereas in a radio play you can make the most amazing transitions in a second. Can you perhaps think of an example in your own work where you perhaps even surprised yourself by doing some very startling changes?
Well, not so much startling changes of one place to another,
But the creation within the dialogue of a world outside the immediate existence of people taking part in the dialogue. In Talk of Love and War, I have two chaps who are talking in a hut, and that really is all that there is in the play. But I do think it is possible, simply through the dialogue of two people, as in Talk of Love and War, to create very many different backgrounds and to people all these backgrounds, so that in this play, I think there are many people who are present and present to the listener who are not actually present as actors speaking in the studio. Anyone spoken of in radio is as real as someone who is there and speaking, which of course is not so in any other medium.
Don Howarth referred there to Talk of Love and War. In this excerpt, two young pilots make light of their dangerous combat assignments.
I reckon our abode has become the social centre of the whole station.
Gale and Hemsdale get more visitors.
It's fair dues. They've half a hut to start with and a couple of good armchairs they got from home.
Gale and Hemsdale. They sound like a furniture shop.
Quite.
I believe they've acquired a chamber pot.
Oh, they lack for nothing.
No. If Gale and Hemsdale get the chop, we'll maybe move into their room, smartish.
I hadn't thought of that.
And as they fly together...
Two birds with one stone.
But we'll take our stove.
Wasn't it cemented in?
Oh, I could cope.
In fact, thinking more positively about it, if we see him go up in flames, we'll execute a 180-degree turn forthwith and nip back and shift the stove and a clopper into their premises while other claimants are still embroiled with the enemy.
We could get shot for that.
It'd be worth it.
Two fighter pilots in a shed, talking about their combat assignments. The plot couldn't be simpler. And Don Howarth once described the plot of the film Zulu as a lot of men running up and down a hill. That didn't stop it from being a superb piece of cinema. So keep the plot simple, you don't need complexity. Now we come to openings. The opening seconds of a radio play are vital. They set the pattern for the whole play. You create impressions and expectations and responses in the listeners. If these vibes are good, they'll stay. If not, they'll switch off. Here are some openings.
Quiet as you can, please.
Ha ha.
Good. Mina, hand me what's the name? Thank you. Dear, oh dear, look at this. Swollen gums, nicotine stains, chipped edges. A right little den of iniquity. That's what we've got here. Uh-huh. Hand me the pronged thingy. Now then, let's have a good probe. Yes. These teeth have certainly seen some heavy action. Not from a toothbrush, either. Chewing gum, yes. And cigarettes, confectionery. Not to mention bean paste pickles for lunch. All right. Sorry. Cotton will mean a bit. Thank you. Yes, what I'll have to do on this little monster is a bit of a root canal procedure. There's no time for that today, I'm afraid. You'll need to come back in the morning. Still, there's a few quickies here I can wrap up now. Nothing to worry about. All right. Just a bit wider, please. That's it. Good. Any other day, you see, I might stay on late. But I have a dinner engagement tonight. Amina, have you got thanks. Yes, I've got a date with my old wartime cronies this evening. Of the Imperial Japanese Naval Air Arm. As was. Actually, you might be more comfortable with an injection. Mina, thanks. Yes, there's rather more to this little horror than I thought. We were all stationed at Mabarakat Base in the Philippines together, you see. That's it. Open one. Good. Yeah, good. Yes, with a special attack force. You know, the kamikazes. All right, easy.
Dentist surgeries are great for setting a scene. We can see everything without needing to be told about it. You probably recognise the dentist. It was John LeMessurier who played Sergeant Wilson in Dad's Army. Here's another dentist.
Can I help you?
Can he fit me in this afternoon? Fillings coming up.
Well, I'm terribly sorry, but I'm afraid...
I know it's short notice, but I don't mind playing over the odds well over if you like.
Well, it's not a matter of money, Mr...
Houseman. Fred Houseman, I am on your books.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't remember
well,
you
Well, I was 10 years ago. I've never taken myself off, so I should still be there, shouldn't I?
Do you mean to say you haven't been to the dentist?
I've got perfect teeth. It's only this one, look. Well,
I'm very sorry, Mr. Houseman. If you are on our list, you should have had a letter. I'm afraid Mr. Charles is retiring early. He's on his last patient now, in fact. If you'd like to ring on Monday...
But it's only 4 o'clock. Surely you can fit me in. I'll pay.
I'm sorry, but he gave instructions.
Will you come in now, please, Betty?
Yes, Mr. Charles. I'll ask him, but I really don't think he'll have the time. Wait there, please.
Amalgam, Betty. 3 will do, I think. Now, I'm just going to put this thing round the tooth a little wider. All right?
Someone's just turned up wanting emergency treatment, Mr. Charles. I told him I didn't think he could deal with him, but he's very persistent.
No, I really haven't the time. Not too tight? The removals people are due in the morning. I must help my wife finish off.
Yes, of course.
Is he one of ours?
Well, he says he is. He had a filling 10 years ago, but he hasn't been here since. Says he has perfect teeth.
Has he indeed? So what does he want with me? Here we go, Mrs. Phelps. All right.
He says the filling's come out.
Can't have been one of mine, then. What's his name?
Houseman, Fred Houseman.
I'm terribly sorry, Mrs. Phelps. Careless of me. All right? Nearly done. Fred Houseman.
Do you remember him?
Oh, yes. There we are. All done now. I'll just take this out. Now, bite gently. Again. Now, grind your teeth together. That's good. Again. Splendid. Now, just rinse your mouth out now. I'll finish off, Betty. Go and tell Mr. Houseman that I'll be pleased to see him.
Are you sure?
Oh, yes. Quite sure.
Oh, very well.
That was the beginning of A Fear on Foreplay from 1985. You will have noticed the way the dentist reacted when he heard the man's name. A figure from the past. Similar to the woman with the musical box in Remember Me. Both of these plays are classic tales of revenge. Here's another good opening from ancient Greece, the Siege of Troy.
Tyrrhenians 1, Trojan B 3, Myrmidons 6, Lycians 1, Ithacans 7, Dardanians 7, Spartans 0, Trojan A 0.
Hello, darling. Good battle?
Not bad, darling. We got a no score draw. We're quite pleased. The Spartans are a tough nut to crack.
Daddy was hoping for a win.
That siege is for you.
How did that nice little Echepolis of a Bantia get on against Ajax?
Massacred, I'm afraid.
Rotten luck.
Absolutely. What sort of day have you had, darling?
Come on! Get stuck in the lump, Jimmy Us! Look at them! Look at them, Patroclus! My invulnerable myrmidons!
You ride them too hard, Achilles. They do well enough. It's early in the season yet.
I'm as sick as a parrot, man.
You won. 6-1.
Nobody scores against myrmidons. Early training tomorrow, Pat. The 3 S's. Stamina, strength, skills.
And what about yourself?
What about myself?
Achilles, man, you've 3 arrows and a spearhead in you.
Aye, it was an easy day.
All of these openings grab the attention. They make us want to keep listening. As a complete contrast, here's the beginning of a harrowing story from 1987.
A room, 12 feet by 15. One small alcove, one medium-sized window, one door. I know where I'm going, all right. Nowhere.
More toast?
Oh, no thanks, no.
You in tonight?
Don't know yet.
I need to know for supper.
Oh, best count me out, I'm not sure.
Oh, just the 3 of us then. Unless I go up to town.
Yes, time I was off. I'll just pop up and see Marilyn.
Don, did you ring him?
What? Just a minute. 8 o'clock. Good morning, this is Charles Mose. Yes?
Torrential overnight rain has brought flooding to southern England and Wales.
Did you ring him?
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Not yet.
Well, would you? Today, please?
She won't see him, you know.
Well, she's got to. This can't go on.
Fact. I weigh 12 stone. Fact. I have never had a serious boyfriend. Fact. I never will have one. I am Marilyn Kent. I am 27 years old. I am worthless. Fact. No one could ever love me. Conclusion. I will never have a child. Never.
It's been 6 weeks, Don.
I know.
Well, it's not right. It's not healthy, apart from anything else.
Well, she uses the lavatory. She washes regularly.
It's not what I mean.
I know.
I am trying to be as reasonable as possible, especially after...
Look, I know.
It's even harder when she barely talks to me. She talks to you. She talks to Tansy.
Where is Tansy?
Taking Marilyn's breakfast up. You think it was a bloody hotel.
Well, maybe it's a face. Try not to worry, eh?
Try not to worry. Easy to say when you're out all day. Not you who has to look at her, try and talk to her. I'm Evelyn Kent. I'm 54 years old. I have been married for 29 years next month. Marilyn is my daughter. But I don't know her. I can't talk to her. Twice she has... No, I can't say it, not even to myself.
As you can see from this example, radio is very good at handling difficult emotional issues. The characters don't just talk to each other, they can talk to us directly. Sometimes the listener can be deliberately misled. Here's the first scene of After the Funeral by Peter Barnes. He exploits the fact that we can't see what's going on.
Max, it's too late for words. Too late for tears. Why doesn't anybody get out of life alive? She isn't living. And why not? If I had the power to make her, I would. I would. If I'd been with her then, 2:23 British Mean Time, I'd have caught her spirit as it left her body. But I wasn't there. Turned away for a second and her last heartbeat had gone. Missed my chance of having her with me always. I'm a poor, dumb brute. A swirl of quirks. A tap-dancing ghost. And she was jealous if the sunlight touched me. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Our love caused earthquakes in Panama and beyond. Others were covered with hatred like horse mange, but Anna was never corrupted. Now she rots under marble. What am I going to do now? Huh? Do now? I come back home, the house is empty. She's not here, the days are blank. 15 years together.
Yeah, you better have another drink. These are bad times for you, Harry. You're old when you get to my age. So I can tell you, Anna was the best. We all know how hard this life is on the nerves. But she never complained. I used to hold her up as an example to Betsy. You know, I was with Betsy all those years because I couldn't stand Sundays alone. But she was difficult. They all are. But Anna always had the right word for the occasion. Anna had class. Sometimes she was almost regal.
That's why she was known as the Queen of the East Acton Red Light District.
Yeah. And she knew just how tough our job is. Most people think pimping is an easy touch. They do.
How can it be easy?
It's interesting that many famous actors also do a small amount of radio work. That was Sean Connery and John Hurt. Now, the opening of a play, it sets up expectations in the listener. These expectations must be met. You wouldn't have time for a whodunit, which didn't tell you who did it. In a talk like this, it's not possible to say much about plot development. You can only experience the gradual unfolding of a drama by listening to it. So I want to finish by letting you hear a complete play. It's quite short, and as you listen, notice the opening, notice the dialogue, and the visual clues, and the locations. It starts with the writer, Bill Stanton, introducing it. Are you sitting comfortably? Then we'll begin.
When I was a very new boy to radio drama, I had the feeling that BBC would do anything if it was drama, and I wrote a 10-minute play. And I sent it along, and Bill Ash said, yes, he thought it was very funny, but there was no way they could possibly use it, because the BBC has to work on scheduled plots. You know, it has to be a length of play of a given... And that's the discipline, of course, with radio play. You have to learn how to write to a given length. And of all the given lengths, the 15-minute length is just about the toughest. It has to have a sort of inevitability about it, and it has to build up frenetically, as it were, to the point where you hit the climax and then that's it, and out. And I found it quite a tough discipline to do it all in 15 minutes.
Just before midnight. A plug for The Cabinet, a comedy for radio by Bill Stanton, with George Cole and Michael McLean.
Morning, sir. Can I help you?
Yes. It's, well, I scarcely know how to start. I want to hang it, you see.
Hang it, sir?
Yes, that's it. I want to hang the cabinet.
Hang the cabinet, sir? Bit drastic, surely. I'm bound to say, there are times...
Yes, but there's nothing to hang it with, you see. Or on. Just sort of small ears at the back, like a loving cup, you know.
Ah, that sort of cabinet, sir.
In the bathroom.
I see, sir. What seems to be the trouble, then?
Well, how does one?
How does one, sir?
Yes. Hang it up.
Is it tiled, sir?
Oh, no. Just a sort of box. Wood, I think, with doors.
No, sir, the wall. Is it a tiled wall?
No. Just a wall, sort of wall.
Ah. Then you'll need to plug it, sir.
Plug it? The cabinet?
The wall, sir. You'll need to plug the wall.
Oh, I see. Plug the wall. Yes. How does one?
Plug the wall, sir. Easy. You'll need to use a jump drill.
A jump drill?
That's right, sir. Do you have such a thing as a jump drill?
Well, no, I don't believe I have.
Right here, sir. That's £1.75.
Ah, yes, a jump drill. I'm afraid
It's quite simple, sir. You put the bit in a drill like this, you see, and then you make the hole in the wall.
Ah, but...
You strike the end of the drill here, you see?
Strike the end of the drill?
With a hammer. Turning the drill round as you do so.
Oh, strike the other end?
Oh, no, sir. Just turn it round in your hand like this, so that it doesn't bind.
Bind? With a hammer, you say?
Yes, sir.
I don't believe I have...
I've a very good one here, sir. £2.50.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Then when you've drilled the wall, you put in a plug.
A plug? Well, aren't they the things with three prongs, sort of? Or sometimes two? I'm not very good with electricity, I'm afraid.
Oh, no, sir, not that sort of plug.
Oh, good.
Oh, no, this is a wall plug.
I see.
Then, when you've drilled your hole, you put in the plug, you see? I take it you don't have plugs.
No, I don't believe so.
A screwdriver?
Well, no.
How about screws?
Well, no.
Ah.
Perhaps I'd better get a man in.
Oh, no. No need for that, sir. Do it yourself in no time, with the right tools.
Really?
Shall I parcel them up for you?
Yes, I suppose so.
Right, sir, now let's see. Jump drill, hammer, spare plugs, screwdriver and screws. 1¼-inch 10s, I think. Perhaps a few 8s as well, in case the shanks are too thick.
Shanks, of course.
There we are, sir. Everything you'll need. £1.75, £2.50 is £4.25, plugs 40 pence, screwdriver 1.50, screws 20 and 20 is 40 pence. £6.55 altogether, sir. £10 note and £3.45 change. And thank you, sir.
Oh.
Doc Foster's the hardware man.
Ah, yes. Tring here.
Tring?
Lucius Tring. You sold me a drill thing this morning. For hanging the cabinet.
Ah, yes, of course. Everything all right, Mr. Tring? Got the cabinet up?
I'm afraid I can't get it to work.
Can't get it to work, sir?
this drill thing.
What seems to be the trouble, sir?
Well, it doesn't seem to make holes. Just a mess.
I see, sir. Well, they are a problem sometimes, walls. Don't make them like they used to, you know.
Yes, but what do I do?
It might be easier with a hand drill, sir.
A hand drill?
Ah, you don't have one?
Well, I have this one, the one you sold me.
Oh, no, sir, that's a jump drill.
Ah.
No, a hand drill, one that you turn with a geared wheel at the side. You know, you've probably seen one.
I don't believe I have.
I think you might get on better with one.
Oh, good.
Shall I put one on one side for you?
Well, yes. How much are they?
We have several models, sir, various prices. Perhaps you'd like to come in and select one.
Very well.
Ah!
Cockfosters, the hardware man.
It's gone through.
Who's that speaking?
Tring. Lucius Tring. It's gone through.
Oh, Mr. Tring. Gone through, sir?
Yes, his drill thing. He's gone through the wall.
Ah. And not to worry, sir. You've obviously hit the mortar line between the bricks.
Bricks?
Yes. The layer of mortar between two bricks. You'll need to drill a little higher up or to one side, or lower down, if you like, into the bricks.
There aren't any bricks.
No bricks, sir?
It's a sort of thick cardboard.
Thick cardboard? Oh, you mean plasterboard, Mr. Tring.
Is that it?
That's right. Nothing to worry about. The hole can easily be filled in with cellulose filler.
Cellulose?
Just the thing for small holes.
Small holes?
That's right, sir. Just the job.
It's about 3 feet square.
3 feet square? Ah, you've broken the plasterboard.
Oh, is that it?
That's right, Mr. Tring. You've got what we call a stud partition.
Stud?
Plasterboard's fastened to the head and the plate at 2 foot centres.
Really?
You'll need to replace the whole board.
The whole board?
That's right, sir. Of course, you might shorten the existing board and make a borrowed light.
Borrowed light?
Yes, sir. A sort of interior window, getting light in from one room to another.
Yes, but look here. I don't want a window between the bathroom and the kitchen.
The kitchen, sir?
Yes, I live in a bachelor flat on the first floor.
I see. Well, if it's a question of privacy, Mr. Tring, you could always use frosted glass.
But all I want to do is hang the cabinet.
Very well, sir. You'll need to replace the board in that case.
Replace it?
That's right, sir. You'll need to remove the old board entirely and then replace it with a new one. 9x4, Mr. Tring, standard size.
I'll come and get it.
Oh, you've got transport, sir?
Transport?
You'll need a roof rack, sir.
Roof rack?
On the car.
But I don't have a car.
I think I'd better deliver it for you, Mr. Tring. Next Tuesday, all right?
Next Tuesday? But look, I say, I've got a great hole between the bathroom and the kitchen.
I could send it special delivery, perhaps.
Oh, good.
There'll be an extra charge, of course.
Oh, very well.
Very good, sir. Oh, do you have clout nails?
Clout?
For nailing the board to the upright, sir.
No. Oh, no. I have a hammer.
I'll send them with the board, sir. This afternoon, then. Good day. Cockfosters, the hardware man.
Tring here. Lucius Tring.
Ah, yes, Mr. Tring. Board arrive, all right?
It's too big. It won't fit.
Standard size, Mr. Tring. They're all like that. Oh, is it, near a corner?
Corner?
Yes. Is it near a corner of the room?
Yes.
Ah, then you'll need to cut it, sir.
Will I?
That's right.
What with?
A tenon saw, Mr. Tring.
A tenon?
You don't have a tenon saw?
No.
I could let you have one, I think.
Oh, very well. How much is it?
I've got one at £4.30.
£4.30?
But I wouldn't recommend it for that job. A bit coarse in the teeth. I've got a really good one at £6.50. Shall I send it?
No. No, I'll come and get it.
I'll put it on one side for you. Last you a lifetime, Mr. Tring.
No, I'm not sure I... Oh, never mind.
Cockfosters, the hardware man.
It won't work.
Ah, it's Mr. Tring. Any trouble?
It's too big, this board. I can't sort of get at it, to saw it.
Can't get at it, sir?
The wall seems to be in the way.
The wall, sir?
Yeah, I've got it fastened at one side, in the corner, and I can't get at it.
Oh, no, sir. You'll need to unfasten the board and put it on a flat surface.
A flat surface.
Yes, Mr. Drake, to saw it. You'll need to lay it flat.
I see. Well, thank you very much.
Cockfosters, the hardware man.
It won't work.
What seems to be the trouble, Mr. Tring?
The saw. It won't go straight.
Well, they are rather a tricky job for amateurs, plasterboards.
Yes, but...
You'd find it easier with a power saw, Mr. Tring.
Power saw?
That's right. Clamp your board down, switch on your power saw, and zoom.
Zoom?
Cuts right down your board in 10 seconds flat.
Flat.
And if you had the power drill with a separate saw attachment, it would come in useful later.
Later?
For hanging the cabinet.
Oh, I see. Of course. How much?
Let me see. The basic drill, $25.99, and the saw attachment, $6.75. Altogether, $32.74. To you, Mr. Tring, $32.70 complete. Cockfosters, the hardware man.
It didn't work.
Trouble, Mr. Tring?
It's the table. Or rather, tables. I now have two tables, each with two legs.
Ah, but you managed to cut the board.
Yes, I did. But then the table fell apart
and... you've broken the board. Well, they won't stand up to that sort of treatment, you know. They're made for walls.
Yes, but look here.
You know, Mr. Tring, you might find it easier all round if you rebuilt the wall in breeze block. It would make things easier later.
Later?
When you come to hanging the cabinet. Much easier to plug into the breeze block than plasterboard, you know.
I see.
It's just a matter of taking down the plasterboard partition and then rebuilding in breeze block. Stronger job altogether, and much easier for an amateur. If you like, Mr. Tring, I could get the builders' merchants to send the materials round.
Oh, very well.
Glad to be of service, sir. Good day.
In court.
It is now my duty to pronounce judgment in this case.
Oh, dear.
An unusual case, if I may say so. It is one thing for a citizen of the realm, enjoying his simple domestic pleasures, to be joined by the occupant of the flat above him. It is quite another matter when the occupant of the upper apartment is accompanied by the floor, the furniture, and, in short, the entire contents of that same apartment. The plaintiff has been fortunate in escaping severe injury and has every reason to feel aggrieved. His premises will require extensive rebuilding, and his furniture will need to be replaced in its entirety. There is, of course, the matter of complete redecoration.
Oh, no, no.
All this will call for the services of several skilled tradesmen, one of whom might have been better employed in hanging the cabinet, which has been mentioned in evidence.
Oh.
Well, has it been said that it is the business of the wealthy man to give employment to the artisan? I find the plaintiff's claim fully proved, and I award costs against the defendant.
In A Plug for the Cabinet, you heard George Cole as Lucius Tring, Michael McLean as Cockfosters the Hardware Man, and Gerald Cross as the Judge. A Plug for the Cabinet was written by Bill Stanton and directed by Michael Bartlett.
So, you've been listening to The Art and Craft of Radio Drama. You heard extracts from The Archers, 1952, Under the Loofah Tree by Giles Cooper, 1955, Aaron's Field by D. G. Brideson, 1939, On a Day in Summer in a Garden by Don Howarth, 1975, This Gun in My Right Hand is Loaded by Timothy West, 1970, Remember Me by Jill Higham, 1978, What Is This Here Building by Don Howarth, 1970, Excess Baggage by Ken Blakeson, 1985, Talk of Love and War by Don Howarth, 1981, The Kamikaze Ground Staff Reunion Dinner by Stuart Parker, 1981, A Day at the Dentist's by James Saunders, 1988, Operation Lightning Pegasus by Alec Rowe, 1985, Tomorrow Never Comes by Michael Bartlett, 1987, After the Funeral by Peter Barnes, 1986, and A Plug for the Cabinet by Bill Stanton from 1964.